You are listening to Roadkill Radio. Before we bring on Alex Schadenberg, just a minute, I want to let you know that if you'd like to contribute to the show by way of an email, please send us one at roadkillradio@live.ca. Or if you'd like to phone, please call in at 604-525-4167. So we'd like to hear from you. We've had, over the last several weeks, lots of good emails and phone calls from our listeners and viewers across Canada on all the issues that we're talking about. And now, from Central Canada, we bring you Alex Schadenberg, the Executive Director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. Thank you for joining us tonight, Alex.
Thank you. Glad to be here at the Roadkill.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing? Good.
Good. You know, this story, Terry and I have had this, we keep bringing this story to the studio with us, and I sat back and I watched the story unfold, and I was in disbelief at the callous disregard for humanity, for empathy, for practicality. I mean, here in Canada, we give sex change operations, don't we, to inmates, you know? And yet this baby wouldn't be...
Wasn't considered worthy enough to
worthy,
get a simple...
Worthy, that's a good word, yeah, worthy.
Tracheotomy. And the baby had to be, through the intervention of an American organization, taken to St. Louis, Missouri to get the tracheotomy done. Just give us some background, Alex, on the case, the Baby Joseph case.
Baby Joseph.
And how this all came to be.
Well, really, the case begins in October of last year when the parents were driving home from Toronto and they ended up, and Joseph was, for some reason, unable to breathe. They ended up in the hospital in Ingersoll and quickly moved him to the Sick Children's Hospital, London, Ontario. And at first, I guess they tried to find out some things that were wrong with him. They did tests, etc. But around November, they gave up on him, basically. What they did is they decided to ask the family they were going to, they told the family they were going to remove the ventilator from baby Joseph, and he was at that time ventilator dependent. Now, this is a baby who's, this is a family who's had a child with a similar condition already once. Their first child, Zena, she was born with a very similar condition. Joseph actually is better off than Zena was. Zena, from the very beginning, was very profoundly cognitively disabled, very profoundly. But the doctors did a tracheotomy because they wanted to bring their baby home. And so that's what they asked for Joseph also. We want a tracheotomy done so we can take our baby home.
Okay, Alex, but let me stop you there. So what was different then? I mean, if we did it for
A little more than 8 years, I think, is what's different. I think also there's been policies come into place now around the issue of tracheotomies. I think it has something to do with the fact that when you do a tracheotomy and you may bring somebody home, then often there's infections and there's problems. And so instead of these children or these adults, it could be, you know, because it could be your mother, it could be your spouse.
Or in my case, it's my stepsister who was in a terrible accident and is a quadriplegic and has lived far beyond what doctors ever anticipated.
Yeah, so what happens is I believe it has something to do with the fact that when you do a tracheotomy, sometimes there's infections and sometimes there's problems. There's actually a 3% chance of death. Like any surgery, there's always some chance to be a death. So basically, they're saying, well, often these kids end up back in the hospital anyway. So it has a lot to do with cost containment. It has a lot to do with a lot of things, but they've acknowledged the family was in the beginning did not fight about the condition of the child. The family said, well, we want to bring the child home. Hmm. It really should have ended right there because, in fact, early on doing a tracheotomy was not going to be very difficult. You have to understand that there's problems when you're on a ventilator for a very long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
There's damage that's done to the trachea. There's swelling that occurs. There's different damage that makes it more difficult later on to do the tracheotomy. And that's probably why it took about a week in St. Louis before it actually happened, because the doctors in St. Louis had to try and see if they can repair a bit of damage that had been caused from that long-term ventilator use. But in November, it would have worked out perfectly. And if you think about it, here's a family wanting to bring their child home. If you consider just a basic idea around palliative care, if a family wants to love someone who's dying and take them home and care for them, who are we to step in the way? Shouldn't we facilitate mm-hmm. that? And the other thing is all these people kept on calling into these radio shows. It was constant. Oh, well, you know, this is a dying child. Why should we be doing a, like, look how much medical treatment is costing us and da-da. Well, wait a second. If in mid-November they had done that tracheotomy and waited a few days for the child to heal and sent the child home, how much cost would have been involved?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
We have to be brutally honest about this. And this was a family. People accused this family of lots of stuff, and it was all wrong because this is a family that never asked for in-home care. They never asked for a ventilator at home. They never asked for nursing care or anything. They simply said, please do a tracheotomy. We can bring our child home. Our family is willing to care for this child. To me, that seems like a no-brainer, and they said no.
So how was the child being fed at this time when the child was in the hospital on the ventilator?
Yeah, the child is being tube-fed at the same time.
Okay, and was the child going to be tube-fed at home as well?
The child would be tube-fed at home, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this was...
it's all doable. It's not a... obviously, it takes a bit of care, and you know, you have to be careful because, once again, infection can occur if you don't do it well. But nonetheless, this is a family that had experience with it, and we're willing to do it.
So the... this isn't sort of your classic euthanasia case here, where there's some complex end of life issues regarding withholding of treatment or not. Whether
in fact, it's not a euthanasia case.
No, this is just a simple. It's not simple. It's a complex, but it's a human understanding, emotion, sympathy, empathy case. As much as it's anything here, and in a way, it's an indictment of the Canadian medical system and celebration of the supposedly horrible American system, because the Americans thought this is a no-brainer. We can do this easy.
Okay, so I'm not going to comment on the American system, because in Texas they've got even worse laws than we have in Ontario around end of life and life-sustaining treatment issues. So, in the U.S. it goes state by state, and there are some states where it's pretty draconian. Texas being the worst of all. And you know, in Florida, of course, Terry Schiavo died of dehydration.
Right, yes.
So we're not going to go about the Americans having a wonderful system, because there are obviously advantages to both systems. But in Canada, we have a serious problem. And we have a serious problem around this question about who has the right to decide.
Yes.
So there's been lots of court cases that have happened in Canada, quite a few in Ontario, about this whole question, because doctors absolutely believe, through their bioethics buddies, that they actually don't even need to ask you permission when they're going to remove a ventilator. They don't believe it's necessary. They believe that they have to ask you permission to do a treatment, but to remove a treatment that they believe to be of no benefit, they don't need to request that of you. So we have this whole battle going on in the court system over these very issues, and this is just one of the many battles. There's a case right now going on in Toronto.
Get into that, Alex, can you tell us how it was that the baby Joseph ended up getting taken out of the Ontario medical system and brought to St. Louis? What was the process there? And there was an American group that intervened on his behalf.
Right, so there was the legal group in the U.S., the ACLJ, and then in Canada there was the family lawyer in Windsor, Claudio... what was his name again? Claudio Marcelli, I believe. But anyway, I can't remember his name. Martini. Claudio Martini is his name. Anyway, so what happened is that the hospital actually was causing difficulty and actually refusing to let the baby go. So you had this situation where they were looking for an American hospital to accept this child, and they weren't having a lot of luck. One of the reasons they weren't having a lot of luck is that Victoria Hospital here in London was making it very difficult by not really providing information to those hospitals. Mm. It is funny that they did provide information to the first hospital, which was the Children's Hospital in Detroit, but after that they made it very difficult. So hospitals are not so excited about taking a child without the information, medical information at hand. So in the end, the family did remove the child against the medical wishes of the doctors. They were still able to do so because the hospital had not actually gone through with what the court gave them power to do. The court had given them power to actually remove the consent to treatment, the power to make decisions for their own child from the parents. But that's a process that the hospital had to go through, and the hospital had actually stopped that process because of the impending appeal, et cetera, et cetera.
Well,
so
and
the
not
parents
only
still had the power to do this, to but remove that child.
Alex, can I just
Yes.
make a point here, because I'm envisioning you know, I can't imagine, for one thing, what these poor parents were going through, having to fight, you know, who's going to love this child, who wants the best interests of this child served most. But there were a lot of issues going on here. I mean, talk about expense. You know, a hospital taking these parents to court, judges sitting
it's
and
ridiculous.
making orders. But I also believe that the hospital, at this point, there was a lot of public outrage over what the hospital was doing. Did the public outrage bring some justice to this case?
The answer to that was probably yes. We don't know for sure, but probably yes, because the fact is, there was, you know, by this point there was at least 14,000 people already on the Save Baby Joseph Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
There was thousands of people responding to the emails from Priests for Life, and I believe their email list is around 50,000 people. There was literally a barrage of emails going in to the hospital, to the doctor, etc., just telling them, let that baby go.
Yeah.
So, you know, eventually they would have to say to themselves, is this worth it anymore? And in fact, you know, they became pretty, they dug pretty deep in as to their position. And one of the reasons might have been the amount of money they had already paid their lawyers in order to keep baby Joseph there. The whole legal process would have been very expensive throughout
okay,
the whole thing.
I want to explore, this is not a euthanasia case, but some of the implications of the hospital and hospital's actions. And what you said, the doctors believe they have the rights to do. The doctors say they believe that they have the right to withdraw treatment without permission. And
correct.
And you've asserted on your blog that the province of Ontario favors hospitals over families in cases of disagreement over care. Now, this obviously both these points come to play in the Baby Joseph case, but on the bigger issue. The one that you're involved with every day, the one that you're staging a conference on, I believe, out here in British Columbia in a couple of months, is the euthanasia case, and it's about
actually killing somebody.
Pardon me? It's about killing somebody. So withdrawing treatment doesn't just mean that could mean, well, we've decided this person can't live anymore or won't live, and we won't even ask permission. I mean, is that what we're talking about here? Is that an issue?
It is actually a big issue. In fact, it connects to the euthanasia question directly, because let's consider this even, you know, first of all, this issue affects all of us, because the prime example is if Terry O'Neill has not written down what he believes to be what his interests are for medical treatment in certain cases, if he's never written that down, if he's never appointed someone to make decisions for him, and now he's in a state where he can't represent himself anymore, and he's got health conditions, and his wife or whoever is appointed is now trying to do what's in the best interest of him, and the doctors say no, now what do you have? Now you've got a legal case, and every single one of us are faced with this problem now, that we're all faced with these stupid legal cases that shouldn't be happening in the first place. But further to it, the other side in the euthanasia debate, the pro-euthanasia people, they're trying to, you know, wave the flag at us and say, oh, this is just about choice. This is just about choice, Terry. If you don't want euthanasia, you don't have to have it. But this is just going to be about my choice. And I say, that's cockapoo. It's a lie. It's not true. Because if you consider how the law is working right now, it's not about your choice. It would be defined as an end-of-life medical treatment issue. And in the end, what's going to happen is these doctors are going to be making these decisions. And you'll be too dead to know different.
or say otherwise.
Your family won't have a say in it, is what you're what you say is the
and in many cases, that's exactly what's going to happen, without a question. Now, and then we even go further. So
that and that will happen even without a law that says euthanasia is legal. Doctors will just start making these decisions. Is this happening sort of paralegally?
Yeah, because that is what is being pushed for right now. In a big way, for instance, the Manitoba physicians already have been given that power, and right now there's a case in Ontario where the doctors in Ontario are trying to lock up that power where they have the right to decide to withdraw medical treatment. This is exactly what's going on right now, and it would affect every single one of us without a question.
Yeah, so all this concern that we have now and again when the latest right to die bill comes up as a private member's bill in the House of Commons, that's a sideshow in a way. I mean, that's important, But at the same time this is happening, you're telling us that professional organizations are kind of doing the end run around the law and sort of getting themselves in the position to make these life and death decisions on their own.
Through the courts.
Through the courts?
Absolutely. That's how they're doing it, through the courts.
So they,
because the law themselves aren't, the, for instance, the Ontario law isn't written that way, but because of precedent cases, all these precedent-setting cases, it's being interpreted that way.
Mm.
And so now you have this whole big question, who has the right to decide? That's become the question now, and it's not settled yet.
Well,
and the fact is that doctors are absolutely convinced they have the right to decide, and I'm telling you that if we as families don't have the right to decide when treatment is withdrawn, then it's, we're going to be in very rough shape, especially in a single-payer system that we have in Canada for our health care. It's not like the U.S. You can't just ship yourself off to another hospital.
Mm.
You just can't find another doctor. You just can't do that. It's a single-payer system. It's a controlled system.
Wait.
We're all finished then.
Well, you know, and Alex, a case in point, I mean, I'm just reading the CBC of February 28th about baby Joseph. I mean, the hospital said, oh, they can take him home and the feeding tube will be removed and his life support system will be removed.
They're going to remove the ventilator, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll just let him die there. You know, is that supposed to be some consolation?
Yeah, he would have died choking to death in his parents' arms, and that would have been seen as a reasonable choice. That's ridiculous.
I'm going to look at this from another point of view about some of these issues that are happening with or without a new law being passed. You're getting people who are writing these living wills now who are stating their position, and quite often their position is, do not resuscitate me. Now,
yeah.
The doctors have to abide by that. If a doctor makes a decision, well, you know, this person just fainted, or this person is having a mild heart attack, and if I don't act, it'll get worse, or I can act and save this person's life in a minute. The doctors have to act on these so-called living wills?
If they have knowledge that the living will exists, and that's what it says, then yes, they have to act on it, absolutely.
So
they have to respect your right to decide, but it doesn't work both ways.
Well, hang on, let me just stop here.
Yeah.
I can inject myself with an overdose of morphine and write a letter saying I want to kill myself, and if emergency responders get there in 10 seconds, let's say, or 15 seconds, or...
They have to revive you.
They have to revive me. Well, what's the difference?
There's a big difference between coming to an emergency and dealing with a patient who you have a full knowledge of what their power of attorney or their living will says. The law recognizes these situations as very different, and the fact is...
Morally, are they any different, though?
Right.
Are they any different? Is it really any different?
Well, I think there should be a clear moral line here. I'll give you a scenario with real problems. So let's say you have a document, a power of attorney document, that says that you want no resuscitation whatsoever. Let's say you even have a medical condition which makes you think that maybe it's a reasonable decision. So fair game. And now what happens is that you're at a family picnic and you get stung by a bee and you have an anaphylactic reaction and you end up in an emergency and they can't do anything for you even though you're easily cared for. These are the problems with these documents.
Exactly.
You can't predict the circumstance.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
And so doctors have to abide by that document?
Well, certainly in Ontario they do, yeah.
Really?
Because if they don't, it'd be seen as they could be sued by the person for taking action against their will. Absolutely.
How is that any different than a suicide then? Really, from a moral basis, I don't want to take ordinary action to save my life. As a matter of fact, if something ordinary happens to me that puts my life in jeopardy, I'm going to give my life up. I mean, there's not much different than that than saying, you know, I'm just going to take that overdose right now. There's not really much
difference.
Well, I'm
personally not a big fan of these documents. I do think it's important, though, to appoint somebody to make medical decisions for you. The problem is if you actually do want some sort of attempt
right.
to keep you alive, if you actually do want that, you better be pretty darn clear about it and write that down.
Yeah.
Because if there's any misgivings about that, the benefit of doubt will go to the doctor's side. Right.
Well, I'm going to get it on the record now since the whole world is watching. Be heroic with me, please. You know, do everything you can.
Well, I'm not suggesting that's the best idea either.
No.
Because there are certainly times when we should just simply accept that the death is coming and allow that person just to go. It's okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not that's ready for that are. Yet, though. So,
but that's there's also a reality that let's be reasonable here because... And especially in certain religious people, for instance, the Golubchuk case from Winnipeg 2 years ago, Samuel Golubchuk was an Orthodox Jewish person. And their religious position is that you cannot turn off a respirator, that is tantamount to murder. It doesn't matter whether you think that's a smart idea or not to believe what they believe. It makes no difference. That is their values. And we as Canadians should respect that.
Yes.
And if we don't respect that, then we're going to find ourselves in a serious problem in a pluralistic society that imposes its values on others.
Well, Alex, I need to get something very clear in my head on this. And I've been on both sides of this fence. I was, as I mentioned earlier, my sister was in a horrific water ski accident where she hurt her back got broken and she was put into hospital in a coma. We were told that, you know, she's not going to make it. We should pull the plug, all those kinds of things. You know, this goes back almost 30 years now. She's one of the oldest living quadriplegics in California. The doctors don't know what to do with her because they've never had, you know, a patient live this long and have such a productive life because she went on to be a great advocate for other quadriplegics and those kinds of things. I think 4 months pregnant with my second child down in a hospital in California, monitoring doctors, making sure nobody pulled the plug. Conversely, when my mom was very ill and with cancer and didn't want to be resuscitated. So I've been on both sides of this fence.
Yep.
But what I'm hearing now is if I don't want to be resuscitated and I sign that order, then doctors are going to abide by that. But if I want to be like Terry and have heroic measures taken and am on a ventilator, a doctor can veto my wishes and remove that medical treatment?
Well, that's what they're pushing for, is having the absolute right to do. That's the big push right now. The fact of it is that you would find yourself often in a court, especially in the Ontario rules. In Ontario, when there's a difference of belief between the doctor's medical plan and the family, they go to something called the Consent and Capacity Board, which is what happened to Baby Joseph.
Hmm.
So Baby Joseph, it was actually a ridiculous situation. The doctor told the Marashli family that they were going to be going to a committee hearing to make decisions as to what to do about Baby Joseph's health condition. And so the Marashli family showed up without a lawyer, not knowing what was going on. And the first thing the judge at the Consent and Capacity Board said is, why don't you have a lawyer? And the Marashli family said, no one told us anything about what we would need.
Mm-hmm.
So wow. Then they went out and they just got this student lawyer, newly passed the bar lawyer. And basically on legal aid and the rest of it, and it ended up becoming a travesty of justice, and then they challenged it to the Superior Court and had the same situation where they had a legal aid lawyer who really didn't even make an argument in their favor, and it becomes a second travesty of justice. You know, the hospital's not that innocent. The hospital comes out with top-notch lawyers who know the law very well, who know this particular area of law extremely well, and of course they argue to win.
Yes.
So is that called justice?
Yeah.
Is this called justice when you've got a family defending their beliefs to care for their child and to bring their child home, and their legal team isn't even barely supporting their position?
Okay.
Is that called justice?
But there was a group that got involved in the Baby Joseph case that kind of leveled the playing field a little bit.
Got involved and we paid for a top-notch lawyer, and then after that, the ACLJ got involved. And then the family then hired this Claudio after that. So, in fact, after that point, they did get good legal support.
What's ACLJ stand for?
Oh, American Center for Law and Justice,
okay.
I believe.
Okay.
Yes, so. And of course, they were all made fun of because they worked closely with Sarah Palin. And so a lot of people were making fun of them.
That would,
well, I would suggest that in this case, the joke is on those guys. Right. You know, so the American cavalry came in after you guys got this ball rolling. And how were the decisions finally made? The parents just took that baby out of the hospital and jumped on a plane?
In the end, that's exactly what happened. The plane was paid for. The plane arrived. The lawyers were there. The baby was removed into an ambulance, brought to the airport, and taken out.
And
exactly how it happened in the end.
It almost sounds like a covert activity.
Well, that's what Father Frank Pavone called it, and a lot of people attacked him for that. But in some sense, it was true. Yeah. Maybe that'd be an extreme way to say it, but nonetheless, in some sense, it's true, yes.
So right now, the baby's had the surgery just yesterday, I guess, to help him breathe. The baby and the parents are still in St. Louis, I would imagine, this time?
Absolutely, and actually, it was the day before. Now he's spent most of yesterday breathing on his own and a lot of today breathing on his own.
Oh.
So the fact is that that's even without a ventilator. They're trying to prepare him. In a couple of days, they want to move him to, how would you say, he's been in a type of an intensive care type area.
Yes.
They want to move him to a lower level, and they want to prepare to move him so he can go home.
Right.
Which is exactly what the parents always wanted.
Well, thank you for all that.
And then he'll end up back in Windsor again.
Right.
And hopefully he lives a reasonable amount of time. Nonetheless, the fact is the wishes of the family were simply to care for their dying child.
Yes.
And in the end, that's what was accomplished.
Right.
To me, when we talk about end-of-life care and trying to fulfill the wishes of people and families in these tragic situations, why would you put a family through such legal, emotional costs just because they want to bring their child home? Because that's really what the case was about. Everybody who was throwing stones at them for all these other reasons, saying, oh, this baby is this, the baby is that, so what? This is the family wants to bring the child home.
Mm-hmm.
They were not in any way casting any doubts on the medical situation in the beginning and all the way throughout.
Right.
They simply said, we love our child. We want to bring our child home. Our child will die at home with us.
At the very least, one should expect from a culture, a society, a legal jurisdiction that supposedly celebrates choice. We know that the choice...
And choice
sometimes,
is an illusion. It's not about choice. It's about them making decisions for us.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If we're too stupid to make the decisions that they think we should have made.
There
That's
you go.
What it's about. Let's be brutally honest about it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Now, it's the same thing with euthanasia. Let's look at these recent Belgium studies. I like to mention it.
Sure.
32% of all euthanasia deaths in Belgium are done without request or consent. That's ridiculous. But what it's about is if you're too stupid to ask for it, we'll do it for you.
Hmm.
That's what it comes down to. You know?
Well, we hope and pray that the situation does not get like that here in Canada. And I know that you are certainly on the one of the point men raising the alarm when legal decisions or legislative initiatives take place to try to advance all of this. And we do appreciate all the good work you do.
Good work.
And, I'll be honest, Terry. I just don't feel safe when you give a doctor the power to cause my death.
Mm-hmm.
You got it.
Yeah,
I'm
with you.
That's right.
Alex, we'll do this again. As Terry said, you guys have a conference coming out here, and maybe we'll do another show before then and give you some promotion and let people know what good stuff you're doing.
Thank you. You should interview our speakers coming from Australia. I think the people in British Columbia especially will like to hear that.
Excellent. Good idea.
Good
Thanks,
stuff.
Alex Schadenberg, Executive Director of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Good night, Alex.
Thank you.
Good work. Important
good work.
And I adore what they did for this baby, Terry O'Neill. These guys are heroes.
You're a family first person, and this is true family values.
Well,
my goodness gracious.
It reminds me of a few cases, because I've had to battle the hospitals before. We had one very tragic case involving a liver transplant, and you know, had they just let the parents exhaust all the possibilities, you know, all the decisions could have been very different in that case. But no, lawyers, you know, I had to smuggle this girl, a lawyer, into the hospital. Get a load of that. And there were two security guards ready to arrest me. Gee, I get into trouble, don't I?
You too. Good for you.
I think so.
Of course, you're listening to Roadkill Radio here on the Roadkill Radio Network.